Hong Kong people do not give up, so overseas people would not give up too. So I think there is no reason for the world to give up Hong Kong.
In May 2020, the Chinese Communist Party announced a sweeping new national security law for Hong Kong. The law, enacted in July, ambiguously outlaws separatism, subversion, and terrorism. When the law was enacted, experts debated over how forcefully Beijing and Hong Kong authorities would enforce the law and how that enforcement would affect the civil liberties of Hong Kongers. A year and a half later, many believe we have an answer to that debate. Beijing has used the law to widely crack down upon Hong Kong's civil institutions, from its self-governing parliament and labor unions to opposition politicians and the free press. In this episode, we discuss how Hong Kong has changed since the law's passage and what the future of the territory may hold. Joining us today is Sunny Chung. Sunny Chung is a Hong Kong activist, politician, and current student at Johns Hopkins SAIS. He's the former spokesman for the Hong Kong Higher Institutions International Affairs Delegation. Chung participated in the Umbrella Revolution of 2014 and the 2019-2020 Hong Kong protests, testified to the U.S. Congress on the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement in 2019, and was a candidate in the pro-democracy primary elections of July 2020. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Okay, well, Sunny, thank you so much for joining us today on the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I'm Sunny Chung. I'm really happy to be here.
Sunny, the last time we did an episode here at POFA on Hong Kong was back in July 2020, right after the national security law came into effect. Obviously, a lot has happened since. I'm wondering if you could start off our discussion today by talking about the pro-democracy primary elections of July 2020 and your role as a candidate. What was the purpose of those primaries and kind of what was the goal and what role did you play?
Sure, I think this is a very good question. I mean, previously, 2 years ago, there was an unprecedented primary election in Hong Kong, which had 600,000 Hong Kong citizens voted in the primary election. And then I was a candidate running for this primary election, trying to fight for a seat to represent our Hopeful Democracy Camp to run for the official election, which was postponed by the regime later on. And in the primary election, I formed an alliance with other prominent activists like Joshua Wong, Granny Ho, Nathan Law, and other activists. And then we won in the primary election. And this is also my first time to run for this kind of very large scale election. And then many people did participate in this kind of primaries. And because in this primary, we had a common goal between different candidates. We hope that we can win the majority of the Legislative Council in order to control the Legislative Council and try to create more pressure to the government. And we had one demand, for example, which is about we would vote against the annual budget of the Hong Kong government if the Hong Kong government denied to respond to our five demands, which these five demands are related to the 2019 movement. And then if the government continues to ignore and overlooking our public demands, and then we will use the legislative power to vote against this kind of financial budget bill and try to paralyze the operation of the Hong Kong government. So the primary, so many candidates in the primaries, we share this same goal. And then also, of course, we also consider these primaries as a public referendum for Hong Kong people to demonstrate their discontent and opposition of the national security law. Because if you observe the timing of the primary election, it was in the July of 2020. And right before the primary election, 2 weeks before the primary election, the National People's Congress in Beijing imposed the national security law in Hong Kong. At the beginning, so many Hong Kong people were really scared and they were frustrated about the situation and they would know that, I mean, the national security law could damage the whole Hong Kong rule of law system and autonomy. So many people were really scared. And however, we try to urge the public to utilize these primaries as a referendum to show that Hong Kong people would not yield and they would not compromise their principle. Even the National People's Congress would impose this kind of very stringent and very notorious law. And so 600,000 very courageous Hong Kong citizens participate in the primaries. They vote for us and also demonstrate their collective willingness that they will not kowtow to Beijing. So this is the purpose and the primary goals of the primaries.
Sunny, I just want to ask, because you mentioned this, had the pro-democracy movement ever done a primaries before, or was this kind of the first time that you had held these types of primaries?
Basically, this was the first time Hong Kong pro-democracy camp organize this kind of primary election, because, I mean, within Hong Kong, previously, even within the pro-democracy camp, there were some divisions. I mean, after the handover, they had some disputes between some different protests and political ideologies. So they share different political spectrums. I mean, however, after the 2019 movement, Hong Kong people were really united. That actually motivates and many pro-democracy activists and political parties come as one and then try to organize these primaries together in order to try to unify ourselves and try to find our common goal, and in order to compete with the pro-Beijing camp in the official election.
Wow, that's really amazing that we get to kind of hear like a first person perspective. I kind of also wanted to get your opinion, kind of fast forward to the end of 2020, and the LegCo elections were postponed by a year, apparently due to COVID, and Beijing kind of dismissed a number of sitting pro-democracy lawmakers in the council for being a threat to national security, and the rest of the pro-democracy lawmakers resigned in protest. Do you think these events sort of marked a clear turning point for the future of the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong?
Absolutely, yes, I would say. Because for many years, especially after the handover, I mean, when Hong Kong was handover from British government to Beijing, many Hong Kong people would like to believe that we still have our institution. We still have our rule of law, the Western style rule of law. And then they deem that this can sufficiently protect Hong Kong from the intervention from Beijing. However, of course, this is not true. This is proven wrongly. I mean, after the rise of Xi Jinping, the crackdown from Beijing and the interference from Beijing are escalating more rapidly. And when by the end of 2020, when the Legislative Council election was postponed by the Hong Kong government, and when the Beijing also dismissed and disqualified a number of democratic elected lawmakers in our council, and that is really a very clear signal that Beijing could not tolerate Hong Kong people could have our own autonomy, the so-called one country, two system, the so-called our own mini constitution, the basic law, were actually quite pointless and were not sufficient enough to protect our own autonomy. So yeah, I would say that this was a very key turning point for Hong Kong people, because they would consider that there was no more institutional manhood for Hong Kong people to enter the institution to express the public discontent. And as you can also observe that, I mean, just like last month, in the Hong Kong election, I mean, in the recent Hong Kong election, the pro-Beijing camp, they won all the seats in the Legislative Council election, and no pro-democracy candidate, no authentic pro-democracy candidate could actually win in the election. And the whole council become a rubber stamp, and all people in Hong Kong lose faith on our election.
Sunny, so a month or two after the LegCo elections were postponed and the Democratic lawmakers in the LegCo resigned or were forced out by Beijing, I believe it was maybe the first week of January of 2021 when 53 pro-democracy activists were arrested under the national security law in Hong Kong for their participation in the July 2020 primaries. I believe the charge was subversion of state power that the Beijing and Hong Kong authorities charged them with. I'm wondering, kind of first is, do you think that the candidates in the parliamentary elections in the primary elections in July 2020, do you think that they knew that Beijing and the Hong Kong authorities would attempt to charge them under the security law for their participation in the primaries? Or was this a shock to a lot of the candidates and the people who participated in those primaries?
This is a very good question. I think for most of the candidates, actually, it was a shock for them that the Beijing government really, try to use the national security law, a very serious charge to arrest nearly all the pro-democracy activists under this national security law. For example, actually so many moderate and traditional, we call it pandemic, the pro-democracy previous lawmakers, they are now in their middle age, and then they were considered by those young activists that they were quite moderate or too conservative, but then they actually were being charged by the Beijing government and using this national security law, and they could not obtain any bail, and they have now been locked up without any formal prosecution, and they are now locked up, detained behind the bar for more than 300 days already, and that is really alarming. And I think I would also want to provide more context, because I think the reason why many activists and many Hong Kong people, or even actually foreigners, the international community, would feel like that this is really shocking to see how Beijing interpret the whole purpose of the primary election and how Beijing used this kind of law to crack down on Hong Kong, because many countries has their own primary election. All political parties can have their own primary election. And even if you are talking about the purpose of the primary election, which of course many of us would like to use the primary election or even the official election as a channel and platform to promote the ideology that if Beijing, if Hong Kong government refuse to respond to our demand, our movement demands, and we will try to vote against the bills proposed by the government. And for example, under the US context, we also know that we can always observe there can be standoff, even very serious dispute between the legislative branch and the executive branch. Even within the US Congress, for each normal democratic parliament and Congress, they can vote against the financial budget of the government. They have the power to do so as a lawmaker. But then for Beijing, they would interpret that as a crime, like subverting the regime, and that is ridiculous. So for many people, we consider this kind of primary election, even the purpose of the primary election, are pretty normal and very ordinary if we use the Western style, Western understanding. But for Beijing, apparently they do not understand in this way, and that's why they charge everyone and arrest everyone. And this is really shocking for activists and for Hong Kong people, and even for the international community.
Right, absolutely, Sunny. I remember I spoke to Ho Feng Hung, who is a professor at SAIS, who spends a lot of time doing research on Hong Kong and writing about Hong Kong. And we spoke to him in July of 2020, and we asked him whether he was optimistic about the kind of future of Hong Kong and the pro-democracy movement. And he said it really depended on how Beijing and Hong Kong authorities chose to implement the national security law, and how aggressively they chose to do so. And I think January 2021 really showed that,
they were going to use the national security law very aggressively to really lock up these pro-democracy activists. And so it definitely was shocking. So I'm glad. It's really interesting that you say that. Sunny, I also want to ask you, you had fled Hong Kong to the United Kingdom kind of in the months before this happened. I'm wondering if you could talk about that experience and maybe discuss, did you fear that you would be arrested in this sweep of the people who participated in the primaries?
That is another very good question, I think. When I chose to flee Hong Kong, the major reason is not about primary, because as mentioned, even for me or for other activists, we did not really anticipate primary election would become a reason or an excuse for Beijing to arrest us. So I was not really concerned about my participation in the primary election, but my concern was about my previous activism. For example, I did a lot of international advocacy. I went to US Congress to testify with my best friend, Joshua Wong and Dennis Ho. I also went to UK Parliament, spoke in the House of Commons, and also I went to Australian Parliament and many other places to advocate for Hong Kong and try to, disseminate our pro-democracy ideas and messages across the globe to show that, and try to urge the world to stand with Hong Kong people. And in the eyes of Beijing, apparently, this is a crime, so-called colluding with foreign powers and interference. Foreign powers, and that is also a very alarming for me. So after the imposition of the national security law, and also after the arrest of Jimmy Lai and my another friend Agnes Chow, they were being arrested for colluding with foreign powers. And then I noticed that perhaps it was the timing and the last timing that I should make up my mind and choose to flee Hong Kong. So when I noticed that, and of course, I was being followed and harassed by some national security police right after the arrest of Jimmy Lai a few days later. And then I make up my mind that I should leave Hong Kong. Otherwise, it might be too late for me to leave.
Absolutely, Sunny. That's really scary prospect. So I'm glad that you made it out. And I'm also wondering, with the arrest that happened in January and then also the arrests of other activists, like you said, Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, Ivan Lam, what does the pro-democracy movement look like in Hong Kong now? Are there a significant amount of people left that are still protesting for pro-democracy priorities, or have many of them been put under arrest or gone into exile?
Yeah, I think, of course, as a trend, more and more people do live Hong Kong now, and then they some people are now in exile, and then some people choose to immigrate to other countries due to the deteriorating economic and political situation, environment in Hong Kong. And that's why people like me, activists like me, who are now in exile, when we can no longer go back to Hong Kong, but then we try to rebuild a civil society and our diaspora in overseas. So we will have our diaspora movement in US, UK, Taiwan, and many other places. But at the same time, I would like to pinpoint that people who are still on the ground, of course, they face really severe crackdown, and there are really limited room for them to have very visible and political opposition movement. They can no longer run very large scale protests, demonstration, or rallies, but they still choose to stay in Hong Kong and try to find and wait, observe and wait for another opportunities to reassemble in Hong Kong. So actually many people are now still in Hong Kong. They do not give up, and they try to work on other issues perhaps not the very high profile democracy or political institution, the most sensitive one, but they can still try to find some space to oppose and try to oppose and voice their opinions. For example, they can do some very project-based or issue-based advocacy. In Hong Kong, they still can do that. For example, LGBT, ethnic minority, and other really they can form other concern groups, and in order to mobilize some people, a limited number of people, and then they can still try to preserve the civil society in a very minimal level. But still, I mean, the Hong Kong civil society is not done yet. And this is not, despite all this political crackdown, crazy crackdown, I think the civil society in Hong Kong, they're still finding their way out, and they does not encounter their doomsday yet. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that activists are actually finding other issues to talk about, such as LGBTQ. And I feel like the mass media doesn't really talk about this, kind of on the topic of media beyond arresting activists. Hong Kong authorities have really cracked down on the free press within the territory, obviously beginning with Apple Daily, but more recently Stand News. I know you talked about this on your Twitter, but would you tell us more about this? Are there any sort of independent pro-democracy news outlets left in Hong Kong?
Yes, I think this is also a very good question. And for the sake of, I try to facilitate our dialogue. I mean, perhaps not many Americans audience will understand the difference between Apple Daily, Stand News. And so you can imagine that Apple Daily is our own version of New York Times or Washington Post. And then all of a sudden, and then the biggest media tycoon, Apple Daily, was being shut down, last summer. And then we lost our own Washington Post and New York Times. And then Stand News was the second largest media in Hong Kong after the fall of Apple Daily. And you can probably imagine that Stand News is our own version of The Hill, another really good and influential profounding medias in Hong Kong. And then, however, Stand News was also being, somehow shut down by the regime. So actually we do lose a lot of very influential and pro-democracy medias all of a sudden. But still, there are several independent pro-democracy news outlets left in Hong Kong. They are relatively small, and we are also very concerned about their future in Hong Kong, because there are so many news and rumors in Hong Kong that sooner or later, actually, even for those very small scale media outlets, they will also being shut down and then cracked down by the Beijing government. So I think in the long run, the future of press freedom in Hong Kong is really, is not that, promising. Of course. And I think in the long run, and this is why we are really concerned, because in the long run, I think without this kind of medias, we lose our information flow, free information flow. And we also, Hong Kong people will also face and encounter another form of information vacuum. So without information, without this kind of news, people on the ground can be more easily being affected and impacted by the propaganda created by the Beijing government. So in order to counter and combat this kind of disinformation and propaganda generated by the government, we do need press freedom. We do need this kind of pro-democracy medias. So I think Hong Kong people now, when after they lost this kind of Stand News and Apple Daily, and then they read more about international news, they rely on perhaps BBC or New York Times to cover Hong Kong news. And also they rely on Hong Kong diaspora, try to infiltrate back to Hong Kong, try to disseminate some news back to Hong Kong. So I think this is the situation in Hong Kong now.
Sunny, going backward in time again, you testified to the U.S. Congress in September 2019 with Joshua Wong and Denise Ho on the then ongoing protests in Hong Kong and police brutality. Your advocacy led in part to the passage of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act that year. And that law, amongst some others passed by the U.S. Senate and the House, have been used by the Trump and Biden administrations to sanction Hong Kong officials like Carrie Lam for enabling human rights abuses in Hong Kong. Do you think that the United States' response to Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong through sanctioning officials like Carrie Lam was a strong enough response?
First of all, I think Hong Kong people really appreciate the help offered by the U.S. administration, both administration, because in the previous administration, they started, sanctioning Hong Kong officials unprecedentedly, including our chief executive Carrie Lam and other senior officials within the Hong Kong government. And then in this administration, the Biden administration, they even tried to offer some executive means to help Hong Kong people to work, try to extend their visa within the U.S. This is somehow really related to the humanitarian parole, that can be provided by the U.S. government. So Hong Kong people do appreciate what the U.S. government has been doing. But then if you are speaking of, what the U.S. government can be done, and do we think that is enough? I think the answer is no. Definitely not. Because after all, we witnessed the crackdown in Hong Kong is just getting severe. And then we also witness so many people are being arrested. The whole civil society is going to be dismantled by Beijing brutally. And that's why we do hope that not just the U.S. government, actually, the whole international community, for example, the U.K. government, which had the moral obligation to help Hong Kong people because they chose to hand over Hong Kong back to China. And I think the whole international community should create more pressure, on Beijing and Xi Jinping, and in order to discourage Beijing to intervene and try to impose this kind of very authoritarian ideologies and crackdowns on Hong Kong. So yeah, long story in short, we need to fight for more means from the U.S. government and international community. We need to encourage them to do more for us and also for other people like Uyghurs and Tibetans in order to help our own people and try to reclaim our own homeland.
Absolutely, Sonny. And on that note, I'm wondering, do you still have an advocacy agenda? And, are you thinking about talking to other governments about potential ways that they could help Hong Kongers? Or where do you have plans for furthering your advocacy?
Yes. But I think this is also a very complicated question. To help and save Hong Kong, somehow we need to also look into another bigger question, which is, what is our end game of China? What is our tactic goals to handle the China issue, to handle the rise of China? Because to help Hong Kong, somehow we all understand that you have to stop Beijing. But in terms of stopping Beijing, you have to do so many things. You have to help Taiwan, you have to defend Taiwan, and you have to also stop the expansion of the PLA, perhaps also the Navy, to protect the freedom of navigation in South China Sea. And you should also protect freedom and democracy, democratic values in all these Western democratic countries. Try to stop the Belt and Road Initiative, try to stop Beijing using this kind of economic means to infiltrate Western societies. So we have a lot of things to do, and then in order to help Hong Kong. So I think our advocacy, of course, on one hand, of course, we will focus more about people on the ground. We hope the U.S. Congress can pass more humanitarian assistance bills in the coming Congress to provide asylum or try to speed up the asylum application process for Hong Kong people in the States. And on the other hand, we cannot avoid answering the question about what is our bigger picture to handle the China issue? What should be done and what should we do in order to help not just Hong Kong, but respond to the China threat collectively and in a more bigger scale? I think that is the key question. And I don't particularly, I mean, have a very good answer to that. If I have that already, I mean, I would be really happy. But then, as mentioned, I mean, this is a very complicated issue. And that's why we do hope that we can use our own experience and personal, I mean, sufferings and whatsoever in order to pitch and persuade more politicians in the West to realize that they have to imagine and they have to think of a really holistic plan to deal with China.
Yeah, I definitely agree. This is a really complicated and nuanced issue. Kind of on the topic, in recent news, in September, actually, Beijing overhauled Hong Kong's legislative elections by reducing the amount of directly elected seats and creating a screening mechanism for candidates to ensure they were sufficiently patriotic. And as a result, pro-Beijing candidates swept the 2021 LegCo elections in December, and voter turnout in Hong Kong was extremely low. With this, what do you think is left for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong? Are you at all optimistic about the future of Hong Kong? What's your take?
I think yes and no for that question. I mean, on one hand, of course, it is really difficult for us to be really optimistic. I mean, because so many people are being arrested, and personally, I'm now in exile, and all friends of mine are now, being detained behind the bar. And then we don't have our press anymore, and we don't have our academic freedom, we don't have our rule of law. We lack so many things to protect our freedom and autonomy. So this is really difficult for us to become optimistic. However, on the other hand, we do not lose faith, and we are still hopeful for many things. For example, the whole world is more reckoning about the China threat, and they are more gradually, incrementally adopting a correct path and accurate policies to handle the China threat. They realize how aggressive and assertive China is. And that's why, for example, I mean, in the recent Winter Olympics, so many democratic countries, they boycott the Beijing Winter Olympic, and they would not send any, I mean, officials to Beijing, and this is a very strong signal. And on many and other aspects, you can also observe how the Western societies, they also realize they should try to strengthen their alliance. Biden administration has been doing that, try to consolidate their cooperation with so many Indo-Pacific countries. And so many examples that give us and provide us some hopes that actually when the whole world is getting united, perhaps they can really do something collectively and create sufficient pressure on Beijing, and that will be great. That will be great, and that's why I mean, on this other hand, I mean, so yes, I mean, we are still hopeful for the future of Hong Kong, and especially as mentioned previously, when we look and observe the dynamics and situation in Hong Kong, despite all the crackdowns and unrest in Hong Kong civil society, Hong Kong people, there are still many courageous and brave Hong Kong people. They choose to stay in Hong Kong and try to explore opportunities for them to voice their opinions and try to maintain a very minimal political opposition and contentious politics in Hong Kong. For example, I think Hong Kong people nowadays on the ground, especially people on the ground, they always recall the spirit and history of the Eastern European countries under the Soviet Union. People in Poland and other Eastern Europe countries, they face a very dark age of the authoritarianism under the Soviet Union. But then they can still try to create some soft power. I mean, they can try to create music, they can create different kind of stuff in order to keep their ideologies alive in, on other platforms. And Hong Kong people nowadays, they do use music, novels, they create poems in order to express their discontent in this their product. And that is actually a really great phenomenon that is happening and emerging in Hong Kong. So Hong Kong people do not give up. So overseas people would not give up too. So I think there is no reason for the world to give up Hong Kong.
Sunny, I think there is no better way to end the podcast than on an optimistic note. So really, it's been incredible talking with you and hearing from your personal experience and your insights. We want to thank you so much again for joining us in this conversation today.
Thank you for having me. It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.